This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, we'll meet the guy who started that viral petition to save Indiana Beach and find out how it's doing. We'll find out what it takes to keep bees in the state of Indiana. And later, Pete the Planner talks up a new Indiana-based financial advice service. But first, an update on Indiana's 2020 legislative session and other goings-on at the State House with State House reporter Brandon Smith. Hi, Brandon.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, of course. And voter roll purges. What is the GOP want to do here?
So Indiana's had – so the federal law requires states to regularly clean up their voter rolls, get rid of voters who have moved, have died, et cetera. But there's a very specific process for how that has to play out in federal law. You have to contact all the voters by mail. And then if you get bounce backs, like this person doesn't live in here anymore, you have to do a second mailing. And then you have to wait – well, you don't have to do a second mailing. But then you have to – you can mark those voters as inactive, especially if they haven't voted in a while. But then you have to wait two federal election cycles before you can eliminate them from the rolls completely. And the goal is, you know, maybe they'll come back out. Maybe they didn't vote for a while, but they will again. Well, Indiana, like a lot of other states, wants to speed up that process whenever it can. And you're allowed to do that, but only if the voter contacts you in some way. So Indiana had this system that it did in conjunction with the state of Kansas, a program run by the Kansas Secretary of State. They were doing that for a few years, and that had to be halted because two different federal courts said, oh, no, that's illegal. And so we're not doing that anymore. But we're going to replace that with a system that we run ourselves that looks at other states' voter information and tries to eliminate voters based on that. But it looks very similar to Kansas's. And so there are a lot of critics who say this new system that Indiana is going to adopt is basically the same as the old system, and you're going to get sued again. But, so we have that to look forward to, I suppose.
But it still has its critics.
Yeah. I mean, people don't like this system because they think unless the voter specifically contacts you as the state and says, I moved or I don't vote here anymore, you shouldn't be allowed to remove them is their working theory. And this system we're trying to set up there's disagreement about whether how that would work.
And so this is headed to the House floor. The session ends in 2 weeks. Do we have time to work this out?
I would not expect it to change.
No.
I think Indiana's going to create this new system, set up this new system, and then it's probably going to get sued again.
All right. So has the House committee voted yet on this amended DCS oversight bill?
Yeah. I'm not sure that came up in the House floor yet. That might be next week. I'll be honest, I forgot to look at the end of the week. But it looks like this is its final form, certainly. It doesn't seem to be many more changes coming. Originally, this bill would have created a lot of new oversight at the agency, which is it would have created this new committee populated by like lawmakers and legislative appointees and things like that, that would have looked at decision making at the agency every single time a child who had contact with DCS either died or was seriously injured. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of level of oversight has not existed in this state before. And then they dramatically scaled it back. Judges kind of got involved and said, well, first of all, judges were part of that committee originally, and they said, we don't want to be. We have our own system for oversight. But DCS raised a lot of objections. They thought it was a little micromanaging. And so lawmakers decided to step dramatically back and say, okay, instead of a brand new committee that looks at this really granular level, we're going to just resurrect a defunct legislative study committee. Like there are legislative study committees for education and public policy and transportation. Well, now we're going to resurrect one for child welfare. It existed in past years. They got rid of it for a while and moved it to a different, body. And now they're going to bring it back and say, okay, this will at least provide a little more oversight over DCS.
And how did foster parents react?
They don't like it because they've been calling for a lot more accountability at DCS for a while. And the biggest thing they don't like about really any one of these committees, the brand new one, this resurrected one, is they feel like they're not represented. Mm-hmm. You have lawmakers, you have DCS officials, you have judges, that sort of thing, all kind of populating these committees. And they say, well, where are we? Where is our voice at the table? And they feel like that's really lacking.
The Indiana Supreme Court ruled on this GPS tracker case. Remind us what happened.
I love this case. I think it's absolutely fascinating. So as quickly as I can,
okay.
Warwick County, Indiana, you had police suspecting this guy of dealing drugs. And in order to prove it, they got a search warrant, very legally, to put a tracker, a GPS tracker, on his car. They did that. It tracked for a while, and then all of a sudden it went dead. Now, there could be a variety of reasons for that. And the car for a while was in his dad's barn. So they were like, let's just wait. But then they still, it was like a week had gone by. They weren't getting any information from this tracker. So they went back onto the property secretly and said, okay, let's find the tracker and either replace it or turn it back on or whatever. And they couldn't find it. And because they couldn't find it, they got a search warrant from a judge that said, well, we think he's stolen the tracker. And so we're going to get a search warrant to search his property, his dad's property. And when they did that, they found drugs, arrested him, convicted him on drug charges. What he argued was, all you knew is that the tracker wasn't sending you information and then it was gone from my car. You had no probable cause to say I'd stolen it. And even the Supreme Court justices who heard this case said, well, the tracker wasn't marked in any way. It didn't say property of the police. So if you just in the course of your everyday, found a black box on your car, would you keep it there just in case it might be stealing if you took it off? And the Supreme Court said unanimously, 5-0, no, that's insane. And so they said these search warrants were not issued correctly. They threw out the search warrants and all of the evidence as a result. So it's likely that this guy is probably going to get off on these charges because there wasn't, as far as I could tell in the record, there wasn't a lot of other evidence that the police had beyond what they found from these search warrants. So it was a wild case. It was a fascinating oral argument a couple months ago, and then they released their 5-0 opinion this week.
So what is next, though? Crimes were committed, after all.
The Supreme Court opinion actually speaks to that point. It references another ruling in which it said that we acknowledge that in circumstances where you throw out search warrants like this, that you might allow a guilty person to walk free, but that is okay when you're protecting the privacy of every citizen. And that's what they felt they were doing in this case.
Let's talk syringe exchange. This is the program that provides IV drug users sterile syringes to prevent the spread of infection. Some lawmakers don't like it at all because they think it perpetuates the problem of IV drug use. And it is a problem, but an infectious epidemic could be even worse. What happened on syringe exchange this week?
So this week, those syringe exchange programs that Indiana has, there are 9 of them in counties around the state, they got a little bit extra time to exist. So state law eliminates them on July 1st of 2021, and it has for years because legislators like to sometimes put in what are called sunsets to force themselves essentially to reevaluate a program or an idea. Well, a lot of folks think these programs are really helpful, and they have helped curb the spread of disease. And so they wanted to keep them alive forever. As you pointed out, some in the Senate Republicans just don't like that idea. But there were others who were really worried about, you know, the deadline coming up. And so what they're doing is they're pushing it back an extra year to 2022. And essentially they're buying themselves a little more time, giving these programs just a little more assurance in the short term to hopefully then come back next year and make a more sort of holistic, what do we want to do with these programs for the foreseeable future?
What happened with it earlier this session? Something else happened with it?
Yeah, that was the Senate just killed the bill entirely where that would have extended these programs indefinitely.
So now we have another year.
If they pass the bill, which I expect them to now, it passed out of a committee earlier this week, this would extend them till 2022, give everybody a little more time to sort of get together and educate lawmakers who might have a problem with them and say, no, we need to keep these around a lot longer.
What does the state health commissioner say about it?
She is firmly in favor of these programs. She points out that you have it helped stop an HIV epidemic, a hepatitis C epidemic in counties in this state. And you have Clark County. The Clark County Health Director came and testified and said in his county, when they created the syringe service program, you saw overdose deaths drop by 50%. You saw emergency room visits drop by 50%. So they work. Mm. And we just need to convince everybody that they work.
Indiana was ordered to pay attorney's fees for a 2016 abortion law fight. What happened there?
So this is pretty typical in terms of when any two parties go to court in civil court, they generally – the losing party has to pay the other – not all the time, but often has to pay the other parties, the winning party's attorney's fees. Well, in this case, this was one of many abortion fights that Indiana has been fighting in federal court over the last decade. And that one finally resolved last year. The U.S. Supreme Court came out with a decision that said one part of the law is struck down, another part of the law is upheld. And that's the end of it. So the only thing that had to be decided was how is the attorney's fees situation going to be hashed out? And a federal court ruled this week that the state has to pay the ACLU and Planned Parenthood, who were the parties involved, $182,000. Mm. That's a lot of money on its own. But you also have to consider how much the state has paid out over the last decade over abortion fights, which is nearing $3 million.
Oh, wow. So this is definitely this is not new.
No, we've been paying a lot of – well, we've had a lot of lawsuits. We've lost almost all of them as the state. The state of Indiana has lost almost all of those lawsuits since 2011. And so they keep paying out money when they resolve.
Oof. So what happened to the coal bill this week?
Well, oh boy, it got watered down even more. So this was what a lot of folks called a coal bailout. It basically stopped utility companies from closing coal-fired power plants. Because they had to go to the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, the IURC, and say, you know, we want to close these. No, you're not allowed to for a certain period of time, because some lawmakers felt like they were going too fast, and they didn't like what the future looked like. While other folks, of course, said, well, you're just protecting the coal industry, which is dying out anyway. That bill got watered down once, where it said, well, okay, we can't stop you, but we're going to slow you down from closing these plants. And then it went over to the Senate now, and it's been watered down even more, which is just like you have to make it part of the report you send to the IURC that it reviews as part of the energy future. And folks on the other environmental groups, business groups, utility groups who are not normally all on the same side in an issue all still don't like it. Mm. And this bill might not survive the process still, but it has certainly been significantly weakened from where it started out.
Brandon Smith covers the 2020 legislative session and all things Statehouse for Indiana Public Broadcasting. He also hosts Indiana Week in Review, which you can hear tonight at 6 on our flagship station WFYI in Indianapolis and WBAA West Lafayette. Brandon, we'll see you next week.
Sounds good.
Up next, Dustin Sprunger has worked at Indiana Beach several years in a row. So when he heard about the 94-year-old park closing, he knew that he had to do something about it. And we'll talk about the petition that he started to try to save it. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds with that. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Last week, the story broke that Indiana Beach, the 94-year-old amusement park on Lake Schaefer in White County, would close permanently. The news shocked the community, and there's been a lot of talk among local residents and fans of the park about how they might save it. One of them, Dustin Sprunger, started a Change.org petition called Help Save Indiana Beach. That petition went viral, and Dustin joins us now. Hi, Dustin.
Hello.
So, did you expect this to get this much attention?
I did not.
So, when you started to see all these signatures, I don't know, how did you feel about that? Did you feel the love?
Yes, I did.
And how long have you lived in the area there?
For 26 years.
So, are you 26? Is that your whole life?
Yes.
So, take us back then to when you got the news. Is it something that was so impactful that you remember where you were and what you were doing when you heard?
Yes. I actually just got home from a job interview, and I was on the computer, and I heard the talk, and I just blew it off because we get this rumors every year. Either Six Flags buys it or it's not going to open up or whatnot. And then I did a little bit of digging, and sure enough, it was true.
I hadn't heard that the rumors swirled every year about it not reopening. How long has that been the case?
For as long as I remember.
Really? Every single year it seemed like it was iffy whether or not they would open?
it's different rumors. It's not just like it's not going to open or it's that. It's Six Flags buying it. There's always something going around.
So why is the park so important to you personally?
Personally, it's because I grew up at the park, going there every summer. I had my very first job as ecology, which is to upkeep the park and everything. And most recently, I was a ride operator, and I absolutely loved working as a ride operator.
Which ride did you work on?
I did multiple. The Zero G, Den of Lost Thieves, Cornball, Steel Hog, and the Tiger. There might be like a few of them I missed, but and my favorite was the Cornball.
And the petition that you created calls for 50,000 signatures. And due to scheduling constraints, we're doing this interview on Tuesday afternoon. Are you there yet at the time of this recording, 50,000?
I haven't actually checked it in about a day or so. Last time I checked, it was about Sunday, and we were at about 37,000 or 38,000.
And when I looked this afternoon, it was at just over 42. Do you think you'll get to 50,000 by Friday afternoon when this airs?
Maybe.
It's a big maybe.
Yeah, it's been slowing down the last few days.
And we'll be sure to share a live update at the end of this segment for sure. But there were rumors over the weekend that Florida-based Fun Spot America Theme Parks was considering buying the park to save it. Did you hear those rumors as well?
Yeah. I don't know if their intentions were to buy the park or to look at rides, to possibly buy rides.
Well, the rumors turned out to be false. Fun Spot America was just, they were invited to come look at the park. And they later released a statement saying that buying Indiana Beach or any park wasn't in their current master plans, their words. There were some rumors connected to some executives of theirs making a flight to Indiana. Turns out they were here for different reasons. They did, though, offer hopes that a buyer would be found. The town that this will impact the most is Monticello, and Mayor Kathy Gross recently said that the news was a blow to the community. But she also said that a petition, I'm sure she's referring to your petition, wouldn't do anything more than the town is already doing. What do you say to that?
I agree to it. I know it's not going to do a whole lot, but it's basically a platform. It can wear awareness to potential buyers and hopefully that'll encourage somebody to buy it down the road.
And you have an event planned for tomorrow, Saturday the 29th. This is when the annual hiring fair for the park's seasonal workers would have been. What are you planning?
It's basically a rally to like show how much support Indiana Beach has. And basically what we want to do is have people make signs that say anywhere from I love Indiana Beach to save our park or save Indiana Beach. And we're going to line the streets up from the north entrance to the south entrance if we have enough people to do that. Something to make people look, wow, wow, that's a lot of people.
Where are you doing this?
At Indiana Beach. We're going to start and meet up at the north lot.
Right by the north entrance there?
It's going to be up the hill.
And you already have a good bit of support, and it looks like you might have a good crowd, but I'm sure you'll be happy to take more people. What would you want to say to people who are thinking about coming?
Come and show your support, show your love, try to save our park.
So if someone is, let's say someone's listening right now who could do something, maybe somebody who knows someone who might be in a position to buy the park, save the park, something like that. What would you say to them?
I would say to them, listen to the visitors who have visited the park for decades. Those are the people that will keep coming back and bring the park's image back to what it used to be.
Dustin Sprunger is a former employee of Indiana Beach. He worked there for several seasons and has been going there his whole life. He created the Change.org petition called Help Save Indiana Beach, and he's hosting a meetup tomorrow at noon at the park's north entrance to show support for keeping the park open after the news came out last week that the park would be closing permanently. Dustin, we'll be following this closely. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
And by the way, at the time of this broadcast right now, Dustin's petition to save Indiana Beach is now just north of 46,000 signatures, so less than 4,000 to go to hit that 50,000 mark. Well, if you're a beekeeper or you're interested in keeping bees, you may already be planning your trip to Indianapolis this weekend for Indiana Bee School. It's a requirement in some parts of the state. I'm here with the chair of the Indiana Bee School, Debbie Seib. Hi, Debbie.
Hello.
And one of their honored guests for the weekend, all the way from Parker, Texas, American honeybee queen Mary Reisinger. Welcome to Indiana, Mary.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
Have you been here before?
I haven't. It's my first time.
First time in Indiana?
It is, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you're going to love the city. So, Debbie, what is the Indiana Bee School?
It is a bee school we put on every year. It's our 18th year. We actually bring in a guest speaker. The guest speaker is someone internationally known. This year it's Dr. Marla Spivak. And we also have five other classes going on at the same time, supplemented by beekeepers in the state of Indiana. One of them is Dr. Brock Harper. He is our new entomologist at Purdue. Mm. And then we have a 200 class for beginning beekeepers, which are brand new beekeepers who do not have hives yet.
How long have Beekeepers of Indiana been around as an organization?
Since 1879, we've had an organization here for beekeepers, yeah.
Wow. That's a long time.
It's a long time.
What did you have to do in 1879? Everything was a lot different. People got stung probably a lot more often.
Back then, we had a saying that you were just a beekeeper. You had bees, but you didn't really have to do much to them. And now we have to do a lot. We have to watch them, protect them, treat them for varroa mites, make sure they have enough food, pollination, enough pollen to make sure they have the right types of food, not just food.
Mm. And just so everyone knows, registration is closed for Indiana Bee School this weekend, and you don't accept walk-ins. So we're not really doing this interview for promotion. But if anyone has ever thought about keeping bees and they want to come next year, what do people need to know about keeping bees?
The first thing they need to know is they need to get a mentor. I would suggest they get involved with a local club. There are 33 in the state of Indiana. They are on our website. And they actually can go out there and get a mentor from one of those.
This school is a requirement for some areas, right?
Where, it is for some areas.
Where is it a requirement?
They have passed some different ordinances. Bedford actually has one. You can either go to our bee school or to be intensive. Avon, Plainfield. Indianapolis doesn't require you to come to our bee school, but it does require you to get some pre-training, and you have to get approval from the state apiculture society.
Why is that? Why is this required among some populations?
A lot of people are afraid of bees. They're afraid they're going to get stung. They think anything that stings is a honeybee. So what we're trying to do is educate our beekeepers as well as educate the public as well, the importance that we absolutely need them. And we just want them to be good bee stewards.
How unfounded is that fear for people?
I will tell you that in the whole population of the world, less than 0.1% are highly allergic to a honeybee sting. Mm. They can swell up. That's just a natural reaction. Benadryl, putting some ice on it. A lot of people just have that fear instilled in them when they're young. So we try to get beekeepers when they're really young before they actually get that fear instilled.
Mary, what makes you the American honey queen? Are you yourself a beekeeper?
I am. So I've had bees for 6 years. And because I saw the fascinating lifestyle that they have, and because of their importance, I decided to run for the American Honey Queen position.
And what would you say, I guess, is your role as American Honey Queen in the beekeeping world? What do you do?
So my job is to travel across the nation, kind of chasing fairs and festivals, and talk to people about the importance of honeybees in our livelihood, because honeybees really are the superheroes to American agriculture.
And you are the queen for this year, so you've really only held the crown, which you are currently wearing, I might add, for 2 months?
I have, yeah. So I started back in January, and I was crowned at the American Beekeeping Federation Conference in January.
And how much have you traveled thus far?
So far, I've gone to Florida for the Florida State Fair, and just this last week, I was in Minneapolis.
So this is your third trip as American Honey Queen.
It is.
And what does the rest of your year look like?
So, I mean, I'll go to probably about 20 to 25 different states, and there's so many different opportunities to talk to people about honeybees.
Debbie, Who else can people expect to see at Indiana Bee School this weekend in addition to Mary?
They can actually expect to see beekeepers. They can expect to see people that are interested in beekeeping, people who want to support our industry that may maybe not want to be in the beekeeping industry, just want to help support us.
You've got 16 speakers, 61 vendors. This is a beekeeper to beekeeper kind of a situation. So what are people buying, I guess?
They're going to see a lot of vendors there. The vendors carry beekeeping equipment, hives, tools, protective clothing, but they're also going to see bee jewelry, bee purses, bee aprons. You're going to see what's called an observation hive, where people actually can get very close and personal to a hive. The bees can't get out of it. We take those around to a lot of our schools, to libraries, so people actually can see those, and they'll see all kinds of stuff.
How many beekeepers does Indiana have?
We currently have over 2,100 members in the Beekeepers of Indiana. However, we think that's about 1/3 of the members of that are beekeepers in Indiana.
Oh, wow. So you have a few who might not be members. Quite a few, it seems.
We have quite a few.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, how do you feel about that, about people who are unaffiliated but still doing the work, I guess.
Actually, if they're a beekeeper, we love that no matter what. A lot of people don't have the opportunity to maybe come to our conference, and they maybe can't come to the fall conference or to the bee school. So they go to a local club, and a local club is still affiliated with us. We represent all beekeepers, whether they are a member or not.
Debbie, how long have you been a beekeeper?
32 years.
32 years.
Yeah, I'm a newbie.
Are you really? Is that considered sort of new to it?
I say I'm a newbie because my husband's kept bees for 51 years.
Okay. All right. So he got you into it.
Yes.
Okay. Now, does anyone beat him?
Oh, in the state of Indiana, yes.
As far as length of time?
Mm-hmm. We have some beekeepers that are third and fourth and fifth generation beekeepers in their families.
Wow, goodness. I'm sure that you have learned a lot, and I'm sure you're still learning things. What's an example of something that a 32-year veteran still has learned, I guess?
I have learned that beekeeping changes every year.
Why
and sometimes
that?
Month to month. We find out about new bacteria that we have, new viruses that come in. We have a great speaker, Dr. Samuel Ramsey, who actually discovered that what we thought was our number one issue with varroa mites, that varroa mites are actually hurting the bees in a different way than what we thought for years. I have been told by researchers, and one of them is Dr. Marla Spivak, who will be our guest speaker, that anytime you open up the hive, you change the flow in the hive. And so people think, oh, I'm just going to open it up for a second, peek in there. And those are things that you learn something every month. And if you're not learning, you're not reading, and you're not really getting everything that you can out as being a beekeeper.
Because it's just like any sort of science, and that it's dynamic, and new things are discovered every year, and so you've got to keep up on that sort of thing.
That is correct.
Aside from bee school, what else do you do for Indiana beekeepers throughout the year?
I personally serve on the board. I'm the treasurer for the Beekeepers of Indiana. And I also serve as the treasurer for our regional association, which is Heartland Apiculture Society. That will be held in Evansville, which is in Indiana as well. That'll be held there this year. And I also serve on the board for the American Beekeeping Federation.
Hmm. And there are other events that you hold throughout the year.
We do. If you were not able to get signed up for the Bee School, in April 20th, we have something in Bedford called Bee Intensive.
Ah.
We also have Purdue Field Day, which is June 20th, and that will be held at Purdue, and you actually can get into the hives. And then we have our fall conference. Our fall conference is actually going to be in Muncie this year at the Horizon Conference Center.
Mary, how important are bees? That's a big question.
Well, honeybees are vital to having food because over 90 crops in our agriculture are dependent upon honeybee pollination.
And what is this time of year like? What is the year as a beekeeper like? How often are you going out to hives, like I said, this time of year?
Right. So we don't really go out to the hives until it gets about 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And so right now the bees are kind of just huddling in the hive. And then when it gets a warm day, they'll go out for a cleansing flight.
Okay. And When does that usually happen, Debbie? When is it usually time to go out?
One of the talks that we do is we talk about beekeeping is not on a calendar basis. It's on an event.
Ah.
So what you're looking for is a beekeeper I've known for years used to say, if you see dandelions, you want to have your honey supers on. If it's above 50 degrees and there's no wind, you want to be able to get into your hives in the spring. So it's not really timing so much as what's happening, the weather and other events going on.
It's a delicate process. You kind of have to psych yourself up for it. I mean, you've been doing this for 32 years, so surely you're not really afraid of it anymore. But, I mean, I don't know. What do you have to do mentally to prepare yourself?
I'm not really afraid of it, but there are always years where you have some really good weather here in Indiana. This one was a very mild winter. It's not over yet, but it is a very mild winter. And then you have years where you get 12, 16 inches of snow, and then you get freezing below temperatures, and they stay like that for a month, and the bees can't get out. And that's when you start getting worried. But what is worse is when we have years where you have a very warm winter, they eat all their stores up before they can actually get out of into spring.
Debbie Seib is chair of the 18th Indiana Bee School, which takes place in Indianapolis this weekend. Again, registration's closed, but maybe next year. Debbie, good luck tomorrow.
Thank you so much.
Mary Reisinger is from Parker, Texas. She's the American Honey Queen. I hope you enjoy your stay.
Thank you so much.
Up next, some of us think financial planning is just something only well-off people do. But the truth is, we all need help. Pete the Planner's in to help us out. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome back to our Friday Pitch-In, where we throw a few different things at you. Here's one. Do you know what you're doing with your money? Are you able to balance paying down debt with keeping up savings? Do you even think you can do both? Peter, I think you'd argue that you can.
You can absolutely do both.
He's Peter Dunn, better known as Pete the Planner, based out of Carmel, Indiana, and he's launching a new service called Hey Money that helps out the rest of us. Hi, Peter.
It's good to be with you, Matt. Thanks.
So this is for people who are new to inviting a financial planner into their lives.
Potentially. It could be argued that financial planners don't actually do what people think they do.
What do you mean by that?
Most people think a financial planner runs your life, that they you know, oh, this is how you get out of debt. This is, you know, should you save for college versus retirement? A good financial planner, a lot of times investment planners, they should just be focused on your investments, right? But those day-to-day, hey, I'm in debt, what do I do? They're not equipped to deal with those questions. You know, years ago when I was a financial planner, I got an email from an attorney at a downtown law firm here. He's probably making $450,000, $500,000 a year, Matt.
Sure.
I mean, no one's crying for that guy, right? but he did have roughly $150,000 in credit card debt and in consumer debt.
Wow.
Right? And so he was like, what do I do? I went to my financial planner. My financial planner says, we don't deal with that. So this was, again, 12.
So this was a different kind of financial planner. This was the investment guy.
This is an investment guy. And oddly enough, and not that we're going to get into this, it was the best investment advisor in town.
Okay.
Right? It just was. And so there's a lot of people like that, you know, the investment advisor or their financial planner deals with their future, but who deals with a person's financial present or, better yet, who deals with their past when they've already made decisions that have created some chaos?
And so you're also with this service helping people that aren't even near that situation yet, even not even near where they can even put money away or even talk about investing yet.
That's true. And by the way, I love financial planners. I think it's important to get out there. I want everyone to have one when they're ready to have one.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of Hey Money is to make better clients for these financial planners. Here's the best way that I feel like I can explain it is if you think about the complexity of your financial life on a spectrum. From 1 to 10. 1 was when you got your first checking account when you were a kid. By the way, I got Star Wars checks when I was 16, and my dad yelled at me because he said, people won't take me seriously.
Now no one takes checks, or no one writes checks.
That's exactly, and I wish I had those Star Wars checks, by the way. And then on the other end of that spectrum, Matt, on the 10 end of the scale is, which hedge fund should I get, or how do I protect my money from an estate planning perspective? Really high-end stuff.
Right.
That 99% of people don't deal with. Okay.
Okay.
So that's the spectrum, 1 to 10. Hey Money is 1 through 7. And financial planners are really 7 through 10.
Okay.
Okay. So questions like, we're about to buy our first house. The realtor says we can afford this. The lender says we can afford this. What can we really afford? That's a hey money question.
Okay.
Right? Or I've got $75,000 in student loan debt. How do I deal with that? Despite the fact that I've also got a four-year-old that we need to save for their kids' college education, and my spouse just lost their job, so they're staying home. How do we deal with all this? The worse the situation, the more we want to be involved.
Okay. And how, I mean, what kind of response are we going to expect from a hey money question? Just something like that. Like one of the examples you brought up, how quick can we get an answer?
Instantly. So it's part of it is an app. And so you can, if you want to use your thumbs to ask your question, so to speak, and text it, then your trained expert will be on the other end, who is either a certified financial planner or an accredited financial counselor. They'll reply right to you. Ideally, we'd like to just jump on the phone with you. And we can get just about anything done in 30 minutes. And if it doesn't, isn't accomplished within 30 minutes, then guess what? We'll talk to you later and we'll do it tomorrow. And if we need another time, we'll do it the next day. And so we've done this on the corporate side. We've done this as an employee benefit for a few years now. We serve 1.2 million employees nationwide. Mm. So we know what we're doing. The infrastructure is there. This is just the first time a person can get this outside of their employer.
You're broadening it to the public.
Yeah, you know what? I started as a financial planner serving the general public, and my columns and things still serve the general public. But you know what? There's something sad that if a person doesn't have money, the financial services industry doesn't have a model that allows that person to seek help. And that bothers me.
This costs something, right? Is this going to cost something to the people who use it?
Yeah. And so that was a big part of the, you know, the conundrum too. What is accessible? What is affordable? Because if we're looking at the wealth gap, we're looking at the pay gap, we're looking at all these gaps that exist. How can we serve towards that gap? And for me, the answer was, I want a solution that's $20 a month. That's it. And so it's $20 a month.
Is that what it is?
$20 a month? Yeah.
And this is sort of an – would you say this is unlimited? Unlimited texting?
It's 100% unlimited.
And calls and emails, and that's how people get a hold of your people.
Yeah. So there's this idea that if you truly understand a problem, you have two choices when you go to explain it to someone else, right? You can either A, understand it so well that you're able to simplify it and make it more easily understandable to the other person, or you can make it seem complicated – so that you still are there to provide the value to always explain it. It is my feeling that the financial planning and financial services industry has always taken the latter approach.
Ah.
You know, they always say, you know, you need us around to answer these sorts of things. Our job is to solve whatever problems in front of your face, help you understand it, and know that you're going to have another question later, and we're going to solve that one too.
Who are these planners? Who are you working with?
We like to call them misfits. So here's the thing about the financial services industry. It's filled with wonderful people who want to help people. Sometimes the logistics of the industry don't allow that to happen, though, because there are sales quotas. You know, there are different requirements of being a financial genius than just being a financial genius. And so we find people all over the country. We have a ton of remote employees that are our employees. They're not contractors. And they get to sit in their jammies. And they get to chat with people in every state in our country. And they love it. They love it because they're helping people with no strings attached. They don't talk about upselling or selling products. They just answer questions. And frankly, it's delightful.
You mentioned selling products. There are basically, to my understanding, two different kinds of financial planners. There are those who are fee-based and those who are essentially peddling is a bad word.
But it's a little strong.
They're selling products.
Sure. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that because that's the component of how they're compensated. I don't actually get caught up in that ethical debate, which is a really big debate in the financial industry.
Sure.
We don't do either of those things. We're not fee-based, which typically means the fee is based on the number of assets the person has. You know, if you have $10 million, Matt, this is a fun hypothetical.
Yeah, and I have real fun for me.
Yeah, it is. And if I have $4 million, you and I will be charged a different amount of money from our financial advisor.
Ah,
what we're saying here is I don't really care how much people have, whether it's zero or $30 million. It's $20 a month.
$20 a month. And would you say that that this is designed to maybe not keep these people, not keep these clients, to kind of jettison them when they're ready to maybe get a real financial planner?
Yeah.
I mean, you are talking about real financial planners, but this is a service that's kind of designed to be temporary?
To some degree. Some people – it's a great question because some people love to do their investing themselves. But they still struggle from a behavior and decision-making standpoint with their day-to-day.
Ah.
So they would remain clients forever. But there are some people that just need to be cleaned up, and then we can send them on their merry way. You know, one of the things we're trying to do as we get to May, which is college graduation season, is we would love new college grads to get off on the right foot in their financial lives by, you know, becoming Hey Money subscribers, if you will, so we can send them out of the nest gracefully and make sure that they're paying their student loan payments immediately, as opposed to the 6-month grace period that most people wait for, which ends up being a terrible, terrible mistake. Mm. So again, temporary relationships are fine for us. We like to see people around for at least a year, but we understand that if someone wants us for 6 months, great, $20 a month.
When you were a financial planner, did you ever think, I can't deal with this person yet? They have too many problems. We need to get these problems right before we can help with anything that they're talking about right now.
It was 2005. I was in Fishers, Indiana, in a subdivision, sitting in a driveway. And I just exited the home of two attorneys who work here in Indianapolis. And they made about $385,000, but they were a disaster.
Ugh.
They were a disaster. And I sat in the car and I thought to myself, these were new clients who were just referred to me. And now I've got some choices. Choice one, go find some new clients that match these profile that are not a disaster. Or choice two, maybe figure out how to fix them. Maybe figure out behaviorally how you deal with that. And not to get weird and dramatic here, but that was sort of the beginning of Pete the Planner back in 2005. It's like, wonder if I could use sort of my communication style to help people understand really difficult concepts. And so that's how it started. And since 2005, for the last 15 years, my goal has been not to dismiss people that can't afford my advice or dismiss people that don't have enough money for me to deal with. Give me your worst. I want the worst situation. There's enough people doing the other stuff. I want the worst situation because I want to fix it.
I don't want specifics on their situation, but like what are
you can have it. They spent $1,200 a month at CVS and you ask on what? And the answer is on everything. Of course, it's $1,200 at CVS just buying whatever. They go in every day. It was just a habit.
So this was just people who are each making six figures running amok with their money, not knowing what to do at all.
Yeah. And I think the difficult part about that is there's some ha-ha to that. It's like, oh, man. You know, it's like when you look at professional athletes and you see what they do. Here's the reality is shame is a big part of this problem. Those people felt as though they should know better.
Mm.
And they felt shame around the fact that they didn't, and it paralyzed them into inaction, right? We have such a haves and have-nots thing. And by the way, the current election cycle drives that even more, that people who ought to know better actually don't, and they don't seek the help that they need. And so, which, by the way, is a big part of what we try to do with Hey Money, we lead with empathy. Like, if you come to us and you're like, I blew it, and it's like, oh, it's okay. I'd feel the same way you do if that happened. Let's work through it. We don't go to the water cooler and be like, I talked to this guy in Texas. It was a disaster. Like, we don't do that. We've just learned that empathy is appropriate in the financial world, and it's also lacking.
We're talking to Pete the Planner about a new service called Hey Money. It's a $20 a month financial advice service. And I guess along those lines, would you say that how much you make has really only a little to do with your financial health?
If you make above living wage, which is a very important measure, then how much you make doesn't matter. If you make below living wage, it matters. It's all that matters. So living wage, you can go to livingwage.mit.edu. If you're a nerd like me, you'll spend an hour on it because you can go to the county which you live in, how many people are in your household. It'll tell you what you need to earn to survive in that area, livingwage.mit.edu. If you're below that number, it's all that matters. If you're above it, you're fine. And Matt, here's what gives me comfort sometimes. Now, we work with people make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, yes. But we also work with people that make $35,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, yet they've got a beautiful life. They have a beautiful financial life. It has stability now. They will have stability in 5 years, and we'll have stability at retirement. And so people always look for inspirational stories to get their stuff together. But the harsh reality for me is it just means you need to be as resourceful as you can with the resources you have. And those high dollars, those six-figure numbers, don't particularly matter that much.
What are some of the most common mistakes people make with their money that you see all the time?
Number one is housing. Number one is housing.
Too much house.
Too much house. Because what you do is you go online to one of those calculators, one of those housing affordability calculators, and you ask the question, how much house can I afford? Right.
And then you max it out.
Then you max it out. Oh. And if you think about what is $1 more than what you can afford?
Mm-hmm.
It's what you can't afford. So you're that close to the precipice of disaster. So for us, housing is the epicenter of a good financial strategy. And I think financial planners overlook that too. And so we can fill that gap.
But how do you deal with that? Like how many of these situations are easy to get out of? It's one thing to decide not to finance a couch. It's another thing to completely downgrade your living situation because you bought too much house.
No, it's true. And that's why we think the accountability factor in this is so important. If you go to your financial planner and your financial planner says, hey, you've got to move for this to work. And you say, I don't want to move. And they go, okay, well, I told you had to move. your advisor's not going to push you on that because they don't want to be fired. I don't want to say we don't care.
Right.
But we're going to tell you the truth. You're paying us $20 a month. If you pay us the next month, that'd be great. But we would also like you to do better with your financial life. Our team has done, I would say, roughly 100,000 one-on-ones over the last 15 years. We've seen it all. A person starts talking, I can tell you what the next words are, right? And you would think with my voice today that I've actually done 100,000 one-on-ones this week. And sadly, that is not the case.
I'm going to throw a loose common scenario at you.
Please.
So what would you say to somebody who has a few various debts, pretty common, a lot of us have been in that situation, a car note here, credit card balance there, maybe a student loan on top of it, plus a mortgage. When you're there, it's hard to justify for some people trying to save because you're thinking, I should probably put this money toward paying this off as opposed to putting it in the bank. Is this a good idea?
We like people to have at least a couple nickels to rub together, and 750 to $1,000 or
emergency
so.
Stuff.
Yeah, yeah, because you know, you get a flat tire and you go back into the cycle again. Mm. And by the way, I've written a lot of books. Other people have written books that tell you how to get out of debt. The reality is with Hey Money, with this, those methods might not work for a particular individual. So when you're actually talking to an expert about your data and how your life works and how your income flows, they will put you on something that actually makes sense for you. You know, there are different methods, right? The pay on the highest interest rate, pay on the lowest balance, a combination of those. And they all work, but they all work for different types of people. Mm. You know, the old snowball method that a lot of people talk about doesn't work for certain personalities. And the high interest rate method doesn't work for certain personalities. So we make sure to focus on that too.
There's no quick universal fix out there really.
Well, I mean it's the one that have people been hit over the head with for decades. You know, spend less than you make. Mm. But telling someone that is, you know, you don't go to someone that looks like they're struggling with their health and say, hey, you should exercise 30 minutes a day. See you later. Like it doesn't help. You know, it's too trite.
Do you think that there could be financial advisors listening to this right now who are thinking, $20 a month, how am I going to compete with that?
They're not competing with us. They're not. We're trying
to
help
them. How is that though? You're trying to help them.
They don't want to do this dirty work.
You're preparing people
absolutely
for financial planners.
I did this when I was a financial advisor to prepare people for myself. Now what we're saying is we will do the dirty. We have financial advisors paying us for their clients.
Wow.
We're not competing. This is a new space. We love financial advisors. We deal with them all over the country. And we want to do their dirty work.
Quick example, 30 seconds. How, with maybe a specific person, how have you readied them for financial planners and getting them to a better place?
Well, clearly getting people out of debt so that they can invest more assets. If all your cash flow is going to student loans and cars you can't afford and bad housing choices, you're not putting enough towards your retirement plan at work or with your financial advisor. Mm.
Peter Dunn, Pete the Planner, CEO of Your Money Line, talking about the new service, Hey Money. Hey, thanks for your time. Good luck.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast is wherever you find podcasts. And be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Monday, we'll go in-depth with a reporter from South Bend to talk about Pete Buttigieg's time as mayor there. We'll ask a public health expert for the latest on the coronavirus to help us separate fact from fiction. In the meantime, we are on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. Follow us for updates on what we're talking about. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend. This is All In.